This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Sisters and brothers, we are now facing a crisis for our Muslims, our Muslim brothers and sisters in Gaza, the likes of which we have not seen for over three decades. And we just found out today that there is a strong possibility of a ground assault. Wallahu al-musta'an. And today they allowed a trickle of aid to come in. There were hundreds of trucks and buses lined up for aid, and the UN only allowed 20 buses to come in. 20 buses to feed over 2 million people. 20 only. So, subhanAllah, we are facing a crisis the likes of which we haven't seen, as we said, for multiple decades. So today what I'm going to try to do, and as usual time is limited, I want to be specific and practical. I hope you've listened to my khutbas and lectures in the last week. I have said bluntly and boldly and clearly, every one of us needs to be involved in the war of the mind, the war of perception, the war of the media. We cannot be involved in the physical war. That's not our task. We are living over here. But there is a war that in the long run is even more important. No matter how painful it is to say, we're not trying to trivialize. But in the long run, the war of perception and the war of PR and the war of aid, because, O Muslims of America, we are the umbilical cord of that apartheid regime. By we, I mean our country. The only reason that country is doing what it is doing is because it has the green light from the superpowers, and number one is us. If our country pulled back, if our country withdrew, then the entire game would change over there. So we have a moral duty and responsibility as citizens of this land. This is not some stealth Islamic jihad. This is democracy in action. And it's about time us Muslims embraced the power and potential we have to influence politics, influence the media, and influence fellow Americans. In order to do that, two things are necessary. More than two, but I'll mention two. Number one, you yourselves have to go out there and engage. If you're not going to engage, who will? You have to become voices of reason, voices of sanity, voices of truth to counter the falsehoods and the narrative that is evil and batil. It is so easy for me as Sheikh Yasir at Epic Masjid to rile you up. But wallahi, sisters and brothers, the real job is yours, not mine. You have the real job, not mine. Because Allah has tested and blessed me to be saved by all of you here. I don't live in your world. I don't work in your corporations. These days, I'm not even employed by a university. I used to be for 10 years. And if I had been, even my tone would be different. I have the luxury of bluntly saying, I am not going to condemn the fight of an oppressed people. I have that luxury, but you don't. So what can I do to help you all? Let me help you with statistics and facts. And this leads me to my second point. Number one, you need to be brave and courageous. And number two, you need to be armed. By armed here, I don't mean Second Amendment, even though that is shari'i and halal and no problem. Anybody comes and says, you're preaching jihad, I say, no, I'm an American preaching Second Amendment rights for American Muslims. Okay, but no, I'm not preaching that, don't worry. Even though we should have that.
I'll preach that.
You'll preach that, he'll preach that. I'm not a big fan of the Second Amendment, but anyway, it is what it is, and so he wants to preach that, go ahead. By the way, I wasn't a big fan until the death threat started coming in towards me. All of a sudden, I flipped. I became a waiver of the Second Amendment, and I had to get a license and everything. And I actually did get a gun after the death threats came against me. But anyway, khair. When I say you have to be armed to the teeth, I mean armed with knowledge, armed with facts, armed with statistics. And so, in the next 20 minutes or so, I will try to summarize key talking points. I hope you can take notes or at least listen to the recording, as it's going to be posted online. Okay, it will be posted online, and may Allah protect us from the evils of memory, the Joseph Goebbels of our times, and of Fox News. These are evil entities that are extensions of the IDF, extensions of the Israeli intelligence, and they have no morals like their own bosses. Sisters and brothers, you're going to be asked a simple question. Do you condemn the terrorist group Hamas? And do you condemn the innocent killing that they have done, of innocent, the killing of innocent people? In my khutbah, I have said, I have no problems telling the generic truth, which is our religion does not ever sanction the killing of innocent people. I have no problem saying this. But I personally don't need to condemn specific actions because I'm not in the place you are. I will only condemn, if I were asked in public, I will say, I will only condemn if we fairly condemn all sides. The minute you want to fairly condemn, I will be at the forefront condemning my own. No problem. But if you're going to be selective in your outrage, and if you're going to pick and choose who to condemn, then I'm sorry, I'm not going to play according to your rules. That having been said, you might not have that type of luxury. So I say to you, Islamically, there is no problem condemning haram tactics, and the killing of innocents is a haram tactic. So if you want to condemn, you go ahead and condemn. No problem. But once you've done that, now you've gotten that big elephant out of the room, understand, the whole perception, the whole phrasing, do you condemn? This is a setup. This is a setup. You are being set up. It is not a conversation. It is a put down. So you need to understand, this is a what is called a red herring. Red herring, you throw in an argument that is not fully relevant, and you spend hours and hours talking about an irrelevant argument. Because it is a red herring, go ahead and just take the bait and then move on. Not a problem. Say, yes, I condemn the killing of innocent people. Now, once we've done that, they're going to say, okay, does Israel have the right to defend itself? Go ahead. Say, yes, every people have the right to defend themselves. Now that they've thrown their red herrings at you, they don't know what else to do because you've actually played the game properly. Now, immediately, you go in for your round and you say, you have said the killing of innocents is a crime. And you have said a group has the right to defend itself. Now, is it permissible for the Palestinians to defend themselves? Is it permissible for the Israelis to kill innocents? You need to go in for facts now. And in order to go in for facts, you need to memorize key statistics, key knowledge. You need to study, sisters and brothers, because the vast majority of people who are going to engage with conversation with you have no idea of the realities of Gaza, the realities of the West Bank, the realities of life under occupation. They have no idea. And they think these are one people, these are another people, and for no reason the Palestinians are attacking the Israelis. They are that disconnected from reality. You will have to be patient. You will have to control your temper. And you will literally have to quote them facts and statistics and figures. In order to do that, you're going to have to study beyond a 50-minute lecture by me. I will give you some references. I will tell you where to look up. But I'm going to summarize for us here in the audience. Understand that Gaza was not assigned to Israel even under the 1948 partition plan. It's not legal for Israel to be there, according to any law. And that is why even the United Nations calls it occupied territory. You need to know this fact, that Gaza is occupied territory. When was it occupied? What happened? In 1948, as you're aware, we don't agree with this, but if you want to be legal, say Israel was assigned 55% of the country. And the Palestinians were given 45%. Even we don't like that. But khair, it is what it is. And Israel immediately tried to grab more than 55%. In the process, they expelled over 200,000 Palestinians to a strip of land next to Egypt called Gaza. So Gaza was under Egyptian control. Gaza was under Egyptian control. And even in 1948, a quarter of a million Palestinians had to flee for their lives, and they took refuge in Gaza. In 1967, Israel launched a second offensive to grab even more land. And in 1967, it acquired the entire Sinai Peninsula from Egypt. It literally came in and took it. And it acquired the West Bank, Nablus, and all of these cities. It simply grabbed them. And it attacked Jerusalem. And it acquired Jerusalem as well. Jerusalem, the United Nations said, should be neutral territory. Nobody should control it single-handedly. Jerusalem should be not controlled by Israel. But in 67, Israel launched an offensive and they acquired, they gobbled up Gaza, the West Bank, and Jerusalem. This is where the story begins. Not the 7th of October, not the Hamas attacks. The story begins by greed, by oppression, by occupation. If you want to begin 67, that's fine. If you want to go back to 48, that's fine as well. You need to tell them you cannot start the story. The movie does not start from the 7th of October. The story starts from before. Now, how back do you want to go? You have to judge how much time you have. You really wanted to go back? Go back to the Balfour Declaration if you wanted to. But most people don't have that bandwidth. At least go back to 67. In 1967, Israel occupied the West Bank and occupied Gaza. And throughout the 70s and 80s, it now has control of around 750,000 people in Gaza. In the 70s, there was 750. Now it's 2 million, 2.2 million, that same population. And they began to restrict the lives, the jobs, the education, the movement of the people in Gaza. They took control and they started banning all types of protests, all types of political activity. And they started rescinding permits. Gaza is connected to the ocean. Gaza is connected to the Mediterranean Ocean. One land, one border with Egypt, and a large Mediterranean Ocean. The people of Gaza would farm and they would fish. That's how they're earning their livelihood. Israel comes in and says, in order to fish, you need a permit. In order to farm, you need a permit. In order to build houses, you need a permit. Now, technically, every country has this. If I want to go hunting in America, I need a permit. But what's going to happen when the Palestinians are not given permits and settlers who come from America, from Europe, are given permits right outside the border? The land is there, but the people that are living on it are not allowed to farm the land. The ocean is in front of you, but for technicalities, you're not allowed to fish in the ocean. Only the people in Tel Aviv, the Israelis, can come over. They can take the, and come in and fish in front of you. You will not be given a permit to fish. You want to build a house? Technicalities. You're not going to get a permit to build a house. You want to correct the sewage system? You're not allowed. By the way, for 30 years, the sewage system of Gaza has not been allowed to be corrected. The same pipes that were built 30 years ago, 40 years ago are still there. Can you imagine the problems that they have here? Why? Because Israel did not allow permits. What are people going to do? Well, whether we get permits or not, we need to build houses. And so they build houses in Gaza. They build buildings in Gaza without permits. What's going to happen? Your son was found throwing a pebble at the tank. Israel's going to come in and say, oh, your son did this? Guess what? You don't have a permit for your house. Why do you not have a permit for your house? Because you weren't given one. You kept on applying, you kept on going, and they kept on delaying. So they will tear your entire apartment, your entire house down, and the UN comes, America comes, oh, I'm sorry, this is not, he just didn't have a permit. You see, they're playing games here. He didn't have a permit. They didn't have a permit to. Now, Gaza, the electricity, the water, the internet, everything is controlled by Israel. The land outside, controlled by Israel. The ocean, controlled by Israel. So throughout the 60s and 70s, The oppression continues to rise, and even the most trivial of issues, you want to visit your family outside of Gaza, you need to get a permit. In the 70s, they built a fence wall so that if you wanted to go outside, you needed to show a permit. The people of Gaza do not have passports. You don't have passports because you can't get Israeli citizenship because it's not Israeli land in the first place. Not that the Palestinians don't even want Israeli citizenship. So the people of Gaza are stateless. They're powerless. They have no lives. They have no potential for jobs. Their education is not even second, it's third class. So Israel continued to increase the laws against the people of Gaza until finally, again being very quick clear, in 1987, the first Intifada comes. What is the Intifada? The Intifada was a mass protest, began in Gaza and also the West Bank. Both Gaza and the West Bank are occupied, but the West Bank has a slightly better livelihood than Gaza for reasons that are self-evident, the location, the strategy, the people. The Intifada begins in Gaza and the West Bank. Tens of thousands of Palestinians march in protest. And the Israelis respond with the one weapon they know best, sheer brutality. To imprison, to kill, to shoot people that are throwing pebbles. The Israeli tactic is very simple. They will respond to any violence with at least 10 times more violence. That is their response. It has been the case for the last 40 years. In the 70s and 80s, they began instituting brutal policies. If your family member was caught being involved in political agitation, throwing a rock or stone, the entire family would be penalized. This is the law in Israel. In the 90s, actually late 80s, 90s, the Israeli Supreme Court allowed, listen to this, the breaking of the bones of children who throw rocks at the Israeli security. It is legal, it was legal for Israeli IDF soldiers, for police, to literally find a child that is throwing a stone, that is, you know, doing whatever it can do to fight oppression, and literally right then and there break his hand in two with a rock. I wish I could show you footage, but it is gruesome. But it is on YouTube. It is on YouTube. Israeli soldiers breaking the bones of children. This was sanctioned and considered legal. I want you to understand. Now you tell your interlocutor, what will it take to allow Palestinians to defend their rights? You want Israel to defend its rights? What will it take for the Palestinians to defend their rights, to live, to be free, to be treated with dignity? Obviously, when you're going to treat an entire population in this manner, what is going to happen? Their levels of anger are going to rise. It's human nature. And their attacks are also going to rise. In response to this, Israel decided to lock in Gaza effectively as an open-air prison. And so, in the early 2000s, they spent billions of dollars. Much of it is coming from our taxpayers. They spent billions of dollars building a 50-foot cement wall. You have to see it to believe it. It is as tall as this wall over here. I've seen it multiple times. You go there and you see this. Literally an entire massive cement wall with barbed wire at the top. Behind that wall is a slum. 2 million people, no jobs, barely able to educate because they're not allowed, no careers, they're not allowed to learn, earn, live a dignified life. Their movement is controlled 100%. If you need to leave, you need permission. You will not be granted permission except with a long list of conditions. And even then, the whims of the guards, whatever they want to do. In the 1980s, by the way, a neutral agency did a survey of the people of Gaza, and I have some statistics over here. Over 50% of the people, this is in the 80s, not now, now it's even more. Over 50% said that they or their immediate family members had been tortured by Israeli police. Over 50% said that they or their immediate family members have had their houses destroyed. Over 60% said they faced harassment at the checkpoints. Harassment by the guards at the checkpoints. And I have a whole bunch of other statistics. Now imagine, you cannot live, you cannot build, you cannot move, and you are trapped in an open-air prison. Multiple authorities have claimed that Gaza is the largest open-air prison in the world, including our own President Jimmy Carter. Multiple people. Nelson Mandela has called this to be the worst humanitarian crisis of our time. His grandson said, I visited Gaza. And the apartheid that they face, listen to this, is in many ways worse than our apartheid in South Africa. Now, I need you to understand this point. Somebody who lived under apartheid, somebody who witnessed real apartheid, when they visit Gaza, they say, this is worse than South Africa. These aren't Muslims, these aren't clerics, this isn't Hamas, this is Archbishop Desmond Tutu. This is the grandson of Nelson Mandela. Why is it worse? I need you to understand this point. In South Africa, the whites wanted the blacks to be second-class citizens. They never wanted to destroy them. They never wanted to eliminate them, annihilate them. They just wanted them to be second-class citizens. You're lesser than us, they would say. And there's different jobs, different status, but they were allowed to live freely in their own encampments. There was no restriction on their lives where they lived. There was only restriction in certain areas where the whites lived. As for the people of Gaza, the Israelis don't want them there. They actually would prefer if they weren't existent. If they could, they would annihilate them. That's the reality. But they can't because of public pressure. That's why they want to kick them out. The South Africans, the whites, never wanted to kick the blacks out. So the level of apartheid that exists in Gaza is worse than the apartheid in South Africa. And the people who said this lived under South African apartheid. It's unparalleled anywhere in the world because the people that are controlling Gaza don't want these 2 million people alive. They want to do everything they can to just kick them out to Egypt, to Jordan, to other places. They don't want them there. They want to make life a living hell for them. So how long before they're going to attack back? And therefore, as I said, as the attacks increased, the Israeli response has always been the same response. There is no negotiation. There is no two-state solution on the table. God forbid they never want a one-state solution. The one-state solution, which would be everybody live together, Israelis don't want it because numerically Palestinians outnumber them. Was it 3-1, 4-1? If you were to have a one-state solution, a pure democracy, give everybody equal rights, the Palestinians will outnumber them. So here's the brutal reality, O Muslims. Israelis don't have a proper solution in sight. There is no solution. There cannot be a two-state because they don't want to give an actual state. They cannot just absorb them back in. So they're stuck. And the only thing they know how to do then is more repression, more repression, more repression. But where will that head? Where will that lead? Even they don't have an answer. Allahul Musta'an. It's either going to be Allahul Musta'an, I don't even want to use the word here, but an elimination of these people, Allahul Musta'an, or it's going to be an all-out war. I can't see a third option unless the Israelis actually agree to a one state. And if they do, then it's up to the Muslims and the Palestinians if they want it or not. It's not my position to say yes or no. But they're never going to want this. So then what is the alternative? What is the solution? What is the future? Here's the brutal fact. That's why every peace talk has failed. That's why even the superpowers don't know what to do. What do you do with 2 million people? What do you do with them? 2.2 million. There is no solution. So when your interlocutor, when your boss, when your colleague comes, you need to bring it back to this reality. These 2.2 million people, they've been locked up by the oppressor. What would you do if you were locked up? What would you do for three generations? You have no future, no hope. There's no clean water, no jobs there, no security. Constantly harassed, constantly intimidated. And then you bring in, if you really want to, you don't have to, But you bring in this country and its founding fathers. Our founding fathers, I say this as an American, I am an American at the end of the day, they revolted because the stamp price went up by a few pennies. That's why they revolted. You know this, the stamp tax. Because they were going to tax tea. They killed soldiers in King George's army. They rebelled against England because the price of stamps went up. If you think it is permissible to rebel and revolt and become violent because the price of stamps went up, then what do you think about a people who have no future? A people who for three generations have been locked up. When will they have the right to fight for their freedoms? We can agree the tactics, whatever they might be, we can agree. But do they not have the right for freedoms? So, bottom line, and with this, inshallah, I'll conclude and pass it over to Hassan Shibli. Bottom line is very simple. Do not get involved in the tactics of a particular organization. I didn't even mention them today in my talk because I don't need to. When people are oppressed, you're going to have multiple tactics. You're going to have tactics that are more peaceful. You're going to have tactics that are more violent. The solution is not to talk about the violent tactics. The solution is to solve the oppression. Mm. The solution is to go back to the core of the reality. What the government, what the media wants you to do, what the Israelis wants you to do, is to concentrate on one organization and its tactics. And I'm telling you, don't fall for that. Don't fall for that. If you need to, get rid of the organization. Akhlas, organize if you want to. I'm not going to do that. For the record, I'm not going to do that. But I have the luxury of not doing that. But if you don't have the luxury, no problem. Just get rid of the organization. Akhlas, the organization is evil. As evil as you want it to be, no problem. What do we do with 2.2 million people? Bring it back to the bigger question. What do you do with the people that have been mistreated, that have been occupied, that have been forced to flee? What do we do with people who have no future, that are being kept in jail? Solve that problem. You want me to condemn? I'll condemn as you want. Will you condemn what's happening to 2.2 million people? This is the narrative we need to change. And I'm going to give you two or three references and resources. Firstly, one of the best websites that I encourage everybody to write down, ifamericansknew.org. ifamericansknew.org. This website is made by an American lady, a Christian American lady. She visited Gaza, she visited Palestine as a patriotic, you know, evangelical Christian. And what she saw completely changed her mind. And even though she's still a Christian, but she is now an ardent supporter of Palestinian rights. And she's done an amazing job. ifamericansknew.org. Huh? ifamericansknew.org. One word, ifamericansknew.org. Secondly, two people you need to listen to and their books read if you want to get more advanced. Or you can even listen to their interviews online. Miko Peled, who came here, we invited him to EPIC. M-I-K-O-P-E-L-E-D. Miko Peled. His father was one of the generals who led the campaign in 1967. To conquer these lands. His father was one of the senior generals in the military. His grandfather was one of the signatories of Israel's constitution, the founders of Israel. He comes from as patriotic Israeli Zionist family as possible. We invited him to EPIC 2 years before the pandemic, 3 years ago, invited him. He was right here, Miko Peled. His own niece was killed in an attack by a person from Gaza, a Palestinian. Did an attack and his own flesh and blood was killed. This was back in the 80s. And he wondered what would cause, so the one who killed the Palestinian lady who did it, she was a 17, 18 year old, and his niece was also 17, 18 year old. He began to think, why would an 18 year old girl be so angry she wants to go and blow up a bomb in a crowd where another 18 year old girl dies? And up until that point in time, he had never bothered to study the Palestinian side. When he began to study, here in America, the Palestinian side, he completely flipped. And he is now one of the most ardent antagonist to Zionism, even though his family pedigree is as high as you can get. So make sure you listen to Miko Pilat. He came here. He has multiple talks online. One other person I'll mention, there's so much more, but again, talks and books. Ilan Pape, I-L-A-N, Ilan Pape, P-A-P-P-E. Again, I'm quoting you Israelis. I don't even need to quote Palestinians for this. Ilan Pape. Ilan Pape did a PhD from Oxford University. Born and raised in Israel, complete Israeli through and through, and he went to the PhD in Oxford University. And in Oxford, his PhD was about the creation of Israel, and he came across the documents from the British government about the Israeli tactics and whatnot, and this caused him to change his entire mind and career. Ilan Pape has done the most extensive documentation of Israeli genocide against Palestinians, beginning not in 1967, in 1948. And documenting every single act of genocide and ethnic cleansing. He uses the term genocide and ethnic cleansing. And this isn't an Arab, it's not a Muslim, it's not a Palestinian. This is an Israeli historian who began to expose the crimes of his own country, for which he got death threats. He was fired from his job in Israel. He could not work in Israel. He had to flee the country. And so now he is a professor. Is in Canada or America? He's a professor somewhere over here. And of course, the Israelis hate him with a passion. But he's saying these are facts. These are facts. You guys intentionally had it in your mind. This is what he says. And that's why I need to listen to him. To ethnically cleanse as many Palestinians as you could. You wanted to kill them from day one. And these are all the proofs that you... And you still want to kill them. You can imagine he's not too popular in Israeli circles. I wish we supported him and did more, but khair, it is what it is. He's an intellectual, he's an academic, he's a historian. And he has actual evidence. From the beginning, this was your plan. Ethnic cleansing and genocide. He's accusing the Israelis of this, and he has 7 books on the subject. Different eras, different... Going back to 1948. You don't have to read all the books, just listen to him talk. Do a Google, go on YouTube, Ilan Pape. He actually gave an interview 2 days ago in Berkeley, where once again, he mentions all of these facts here. These are facts you need to know. So, bottom line, you need to do your homework. You need to memorize key talking points. And then you need to go and engage in dialogue. And I want to bring in Hassan Shibli with a question. Ya Hassan, you are the lawyer. You are the jurist. You are the faqih of American law. What happens if your corporation doesn't like you talking about Palestine? What rights do we have if you put a Facebook post and you say, I support the Palestinian cause? Next day, your boss calls you and says, is this you? You say, yeah, that's me. And he might fire you. What is the legal backing that we have here when it comes to our First Amendment rights, expressing our positions? And what recourse do we have if we get pushback?
فيا ذلي ويا خجلي إذا ما قال لي ربي أما استحييته تعصيني ولا تخشى من العتب وتخفي الذنب عن خلقي وتأبى في الهوى قربي فتب مما جنيت عسى تعود إلى رضا الرب تعود إلى رضا الرب.